Okay, so this is maybe probably our last Dan Browning. So back to Child Roland. So I don't know. Well, we'll see. We'll certainly try to get through all of this. So, okay, so remember, here's the situation for Browning, which is that he's writing a poem a day, and what seems to have inspired this poem. There's another poem by Browning that's famous that's not in this book called Love in the Ruins, which he actually wrote the next day. So it's kind of interesting to just consider that that was the title of the poem that he wrote the next day. It's not on the same subject. It's not the same speaker, but it maybe shows stuff that's on his mind. At any rate, what is inspiring this is this line, which is amazing. And what he is doing is trying to write a poem which will come up to, or at least not ruin the line too much. So what you have here is a case of quotation out of context, and that experience, this is what we talked about on Monday, that experience of quotation out of context being oddly more powerful than what the quotation is doing when you see it in context. And we've all had that experience, that there's just this really cool, really wonderful, really moving moment. And we want to know where it's from, but it's like almost always disappointing when you see where it's from. You could think of trailers for movies working that way. Really great scenes, and then when you see the scene in the movie itself, it's just not as great as when it's pulled out, when it's yanked out for a trailer. So here's just this great line, Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. And so who's the speaker of the poem? Do you recall from reading and rereading it for today? So what are the possibilities?
Well, it's definitely someone who's observing poor Tom when he's doing the whole speech thing. So it could be, let's say, the poet's perspective, like, you know, what he's thinking when he's reading, or, you know, Gloucester, you know, Kent, anyone who could be in the nearby area when poor Tom was doing his thing.
Okay, so on some level, it's someone who does hear or see or knows of Edgar's song. But, yeah, Rena.
I thought it was maybe Browning in this case.
Go on, why?
Because I was thinking also based on what you said at the end of last class, was that part of the poem is, or part of the quest is his, like, journey in writing the poem to get there.
Yeah.
Which matches, or tracks quite closely with, like, Child Roland's quest.
Uh-huh.
So I think that to an extent, or at least if possible, like a part of the speaker is also Browning.
Yeah. Okay, good. So that officially the speaker, so this is without any of the psychological observations and perspectives that Leon and Irina are taking, officially the speaker is Roland. That is, Roland is telling the story of his quest for the Dark Tower. But to the extent that the Dark Tower means something for Browning, it would mean something like what? What would be... It's an odd question to ask, what would it be a metaphor for, even though that's a standard question to ask about poetry. But in this case, it's a very odd question, or at least the answer would be odd. But what is the Dark Tower a metaphor for? So just remember, the last line of the poem is... Right. So where does the poem get?
To that line.
Okay, it gets to that line. Is that what you were going to say too? Or what were you going
to
say?
Yeah, it gets to... It's all prologue.
Yeah. Okay, so it gets to that line, Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. And so that line is represented in the imagination of the quest. To get to that line is like doing what? Getting to the Dark Tower. Yeah. So it's as though the line Child Roland to the Dark Tower came and the Dark Tower are metaphors for each other. The line is a metaphor for getting to the Dark Tower. So if you get to that line, you get to the Dark Tower, or the Dark Tower is a metaphor for that line. Okay, so my first thought was, or let's just do it stanza by stanza. These are really interesting stanzas. They're six-line stanzas. Again, notice the rhyme scheme. Anyone? Before we even start reading?
A-B-B-A-B-A.
Yes. So A-B-B-A-A-B. Sorry, it's just... Okay, it's going to do that one more time. Yeah, so it's two rhymes per line, which means you have to have triple lines, triple rhymes in each stanza. And where else did we see those triple rhymes? Recently? Last class?
Italian.
Yes, the Italian one, the Italian form in the poem called... or frequently called, based on its first two words.
Aristophanes' Apology.
Okay, good. That's the long poem, but the part that we looked at and that's excerpted from it is, Browning didn't call it this, but it's frequently, although he did when he would read it aloud, it's frequently called Thamyris Marching. So it's from Aristophanes' Apology, it's Thamyris Marching, and it's in that Italian form, which is known as, anyone remember? Oh, this exam is going to be fun to grade. The rhyme scheme.
Yeah.
Terzerima. Yeah. Dante's rhyme scheme. As I say, then picked up by some later poets, but it's really hard to do in English. The great poets of Terzerima in English, and they only do it occasionally, are Wyatt, Shelley, Browning and Yeats, and more recently, James Merrill. But it's really, really hard to do in English. Okay, so let's go around the room again. Eileen, are you ready? First stanza, Child Roland.
My first thought was, he lied in every word. The hoary cripple with malicious eye askance to watch the working of his lie on mine, and mouth scarce able to afford suppression of the glee that hurst and scored his edge. At one more victim gained thereby.
Okay, great. So, what's going on? We're plunging in medias res, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know who the hoary cripple is, but he kind of, it's almost as though he's saying the person you've already been introduced to, that hoary cripple. What's the hoary cripple just done before the poem begins? Or he said something.
Something
that we'll just call the speaker of the poem Roland, something that Roland regards as a lie. Yeah, so it's like if you were to begin a movie with someone saying, you liar, and we would know that what had happened just before that moment was the other person had said something, and now we plunge right into it with the person denying what's just been said. You've seen this all the time in movies, so this poem is starting the same way. So, quick, just describe what's happened, where we are.
Well, I always imagine the hoary cripple is Edgar when I was
read. But he's not a cripple. He's, and he's not hoary. He's hairy, but not hoary. And poor and stuck with thorns, but not a cripple.
Yeah, but he got a staff in the second stanza. Not as, oh, yeah, okay, well.
It's okay.
Okay, that would make sense now. Okay.
All right. So, all right. So, just if you were just quickly imagine a context for this.
A knight is on his way somewhere, but it's very difficult, and he was lied to by the hoary cripple about how hard it was going to be.
Okay. Good. So, what do you think of those first four words? So, yeah. So remember that Browning, one of the amazing things about this poem, this is why I'm going to repeat for a third time, because it is so amazing, is that he wrote this poem in one day while he was giving himself a task of writing a poem a day. So it's not like he sat down and thought about this and revised it and let it be something that he worked on for years and years and years. It's like the opposite of an Elizabeth Bishop poem, where it would take Elizabeth Bishop sometimes 40 years to be satisfied with a poem that she'd written. So this is the opposite of that. So he's sitting down and he's got to write. And then there's this line in Shakespeare, "Child Roland to the Dark Tower came." And, you know, April is NaPoWriMo, you know that, National Poetry Writing Month? Okay, so just imagine you're supposed to write a poem a day. It's April. You're supposed to write a poem a day. So April 13th, you just say, all right, Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. I'm going to do something with that. Okay, so what do you do? You got to go immediately. You got to improvise. So what do you go with as you start improvising?
With your first thought.
Yes. So, my first thought was, he lied in every word. And that's what gets him into the poem, is that he's got to have a first thought. And so, my first thought, but first thoughts, are they right or are they wrong, generally, in a story? Not in real life, not maybe in an account of a story, but in a story. Just any story that begins with my first thought, is that going to turn out to be true or false, that thought?
False.
Yeah, I mean, that's how stories work. My
stories
first...
Razor.
Sorry?
Stories defy
Occam's. Yes, exactly. My first thought was Cinderella would end up a princess. Turned out to be true. The end. So, first thoughts have to be corrected. Stories are always corrections of... what the reader or audience is thinking. So Browning is doing that. This is one of those places. I won't keep saying this, and they won't. This isn't simply something that you can say phrase by phrase or word by word, but it's one of those places where Browning and Roland are in sync with each other, let's say, which is going with their first thoughts. So my first thought was, he lied in every word. Who lied in every word?
The hoary cripple.
With malicious eye. So I'll just say this parenthetically, because it's somewhere back of Browning's mind here, but the idea of poets as liars is... an old idea that goes back to Plato and that becomes part of an argument about whether poetry is destructive and prevents... I mean, it's part of the argument that we've been talking about, that both EBB and Browning are engaged in, which is poetry useful or is it something that is going to distract people from truth? Is it mind candy, brain candy, which is going to rot the teeth of truth, or is it something that's useful? So the very famous line that Sir Philip Sidney has in his apology for poetry is that he says, people say poets are liars. He says that's not so because... famous line, the poet nothing lieth because he nothing affirmeth. So the idea is that poems aren't asking you to treat them as true stories. Whatever they are, they're orthogonal to the idea of truth or falsity. But so here then is the question. My first thought was he lied in every word. Maybe we're dealing with a similar issue. Is poetry a set of lies or not? Okay, who the hoary cripple? What's the cripple's eye look like?
Malicious.
Malicious, full of malice. It's askance, with malicious eye, askance to watch the working of his lie on mine. So what does it mean that his eye is askance? What does it mean to look at someone askance? Yeah, it's to give him the side look, right? I mean, literally. So he's lying, and what's he doing? At least what does Roland think he's doing? His mouth is scarce able to afford suppression of the glee that he's feeling. So, yeah, but it's like he's telling a lie, and he's looking out of the corner of his eye at Roland. And so Roland sees that the cripple wants to see whether he is buying the lie that the cripple is telling him. He's got a malicious eye watching the working of his lie on mine, on what? What, my what?
His eye?
Yeah, so it looks like he's looking at me to see how his eye works, to see how his lie works on me on the basis of how I look. So he's watching my eyes to see if I believe him. But there's also the suppressed possibility, the working of his lie on my lie. That is, he's telling a lie, whatever lie it is, which we're about to find out, and I'm telling a lie because I'm a poet, because I, Robert Browning, am writing this story as though I were Child Roland. So again, it's suppressed. That's not the obvious meaning. If God said there's only one meaning, which is it? It would be my I. But there's that mine is just slightly ambiguous. His mouth was scarce able to afford suppression of the glee, so he can't stop himself from smirking. The glee that pursed and scored its edge, his mouth's edge, at one more victim gained thereby. So, yes, he's got another victim now. So now we have a sense of this hoary cripple as someone who is posted somewhere and tricks people and makes them his victim. So one more victim gained thereby. So hang on to the idea that there's one more victim. Sophia.
What else should he be set for with his staff? What, save to waylay with his lies and snare all travelers who might find him posted there and ask the road, I guess what skull like laugh would break, what crutch can write my epitaph.
Yeah, rhymes with laugh.
For pastime in the dusty thoroughfare.
Keep reading, get to the end of the sentence.
At his counsel, I should turn aside into that ominous track which all agree hides with the dark.
Okay, that's good. You don't have to keep. You got to the end of the sentence. Well done. So, what else should he be set for with his staff? So, set by whom? Well, in a way, that's the question. Why is he there? Because this is a kind of Joseph Campbell adventure, right? And the first thing you have to do is get by the hoary cripple who lies to people who ask directions. You can imagine it as a game, too, if you were playing this as a first-person game. This would be the first achievement that you would have to unlock is figuring out what to do with this hoary cripple. So why is he there if not to do what?
Yeah.
And then I guess what skull-like laugh would break, what crutch gin, short for?
Begin.
What crutch gin write my epitaph for pastime in the dusty thoroughfare. So he's guessing what the hoary cripple's going to do, which is do what?
Break into a laugh once the poor sap's gone.
Yeah, and start writing his epitaph in the dust for pastime. Start writing, another fool who believed me. if at his counsel I should turn aside into that ominous tract which all agree hides the Dark Tower. So when will he laugh? When will he write Roland's epitaph? What would Roland do that would make him do that?
If he actually goes to, if he actually believes him and follows where he points him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if at his counsel I should turn aside. So if I believed what he said, if I did what he said I had to do, turn aside towards what? Towards the Dark Tower. If at his counsel I should turn aside into that ominous tract. So what does tract mean there? Well, a tract usually means a plot of land. So there, you would have a path through a plot of land. But a tract, or you might not. But a tract means some land that you think of as a piece of land rather than the road that he's on, which is a road going from one, which is the thoroughfare that he's on. So he's walking down a dusty thoroughfare. He finds the hoary cripple. He asks the hoary cripple something. The hoary cripple points him off the road, turn aside, into that ominous tract. Do you know what else tract can mean?
Like a document.
Like a document or a book or a poem or maybe a printed play. So the ominous tract in that meaning would be what? Yeah, hiding the Dark Tower. So if I were to try to get to Child Roland to the Dark Tower Canyon, all agree that that's where the line is hidden. The meaning of the line, not so well known, but where can it be found? In that very ominous play, in that ominous book that the title of the poem is quoting from. Okay, now here is the first puzzle. You may think we've done puzzles so far, but we haven't. Here's the first real puzzle in the poem. And in a sense, the central puzzle of the poem that we're going to see several versions of all the way through. I should tell you, by the way, that I taught this poem at Brandeis for quite a long time, and some students over the decades get obsessed with it. So it's a poem that's worth getting obsessed with, and I hope you will too. So, first puzzle. So what did he ask the hoary cripple?
Which way to go?
Which way to go looking for, like, Yuzdan?
I mean, I thought it was which way toward the Dark Tower.
Yes. Yeah, clearly. It has to be. In a sense, it has to be not logically, but by the logic of what a quest, what a poem of quest looks like. The title tells you it's that there is, it's a full sentence title, which are rare. Can you quickly think of any other full sentence titles? I hear the mermaid singing, maybe.
I wonder lonely as a clown.
Yeah, but that's a first line title, but an actual title.
But I couldn't stop for that.
That's the first line. Yeah, I mean, just think of titles of books.
Everyone in this room will someday be dead.
Okay.
Recent books, but just for an example.
For Whom the Bell Tolls is not a sentence.
The sun still rises.
The sun also rises. Good. Good. The sun also rises. That's a good one. And, of course, that's quotation. So it's title as quotation. So here you have a full sentence title. And in some sense, the parentheses right under it, C. Edgar's Song in Lear, is telling you that you don't need to know that that's Edgar's song. I mean, you should, but you don't need to know it. Because the title is a standalone, but if you want to know where it comes from King Lear. So the standalone, therefore, has to be telling you what's going to happen, which is that Child Roland is going to get to the Dark Tower, which therefore has to mean that that's what the quest is about. again, it doesn't have to mean this logically. It could be something like, you could imagine that the title could be paraphrased as, Child Roland really blew it. Child Roland failed completely. And then you would know where the poem was going. But it just, the line is so powerful that it can't mean that. Poetically, it can't mean that, right? Does that make sense? It's got to be the goal of the poem as it is the goal of the quester. So then the puzzle is, if all agree that that's where the Dark Tower is, why would he think that's a lie? And you could say, well, it's a double-crossing psych out. There's a joke Freud tells. He likes this as a Jewish joke that two men meet on a train, and one says to the other, "Izzy, where are you going?" And Izzy says, "I'm going to Mintz." And the first one says, "Why are you trying to fool me into thinking that you're going to Warsaw when I actually know that you're going to Mintz?" And the joke is, people don't tend to laugh at Freud's jokes. There's like only one or two that are actually funny. But the joke is that you tell someone the truth because they're expecting you to lie. So when you tell them the truth, they think you're lying. And therefore, they think you're trying to fool them. So I know you're going to Mintz. So why would you tell me you're going to Mintz? Because you're trying to fool me into thinking that you're lying and not going to Mintz. That's not what's going on here. It's not that the hoary cripple is saying, yeah, the Dark Tower is over there, so that Roland would say, yeah, but this hoary cripple is going to be a liar. So if he says the Dark Tower is in that direction, it can't be in that direction. So now I know I better not turn aside into that ominous tract. Because the ominous tract, if it's King Lear, that is where the Dark Tower is hidden. That is where you're supposed to be going. So, pick it up from theirs, yet acquiescingly.
Yet acquiescingly, I did turn as you pointed, neither pride nor hope rekindling at the end described. So much as gladness that some end might be.
Okay. So first of all, acquiescingly, very few poets will use that in a line of poetry. That's a hard word, especially a rhyme word. But you know, that's Browning. So what happens? Yeah.
He follows the hoary cripple's directions.
Yeah. And how does he feel about that?
Good.
Not good.
Kind of just resigned.
Yeah. So, okay, I did turn as he pointed. Not feeling hope or pride. So hope and pride would have been how he would have felt when. What does that tell you about the start of his quest, now not of Browning's quest, but Roland's quest?
Doesn't have high hopes for the finale.
Yeah, he did once. But now they don't rekindle. So he burned with hope, he burned with pride. I am going to quest for the Dark Tower. But not anymore. Now the gladness is simply what? Yeah. Just get it over with. It's exhaustion. It's despair. So neither pride nor hope rekindling at the end descried, so much as gladness that some end might be. And then he's going to give you a little backstory for that. So Samantha.
For what with my whole world glad wandering, but with my search strong out 3 years, my hope would that have struck out. I hope dwindled into a ghost not fit to cope with that obstreperous joy success would bring. I hardly tried now to rebuke the spring. My heart made, finding failure in its scope.
Okay, so paraphrase. So, gladness that some end might be. Why?
Because he's been wandering for years.
Uh-huh.
And he started out optimistic, and he thought he would succeed, and he was super excited about it, but now he's just kind of over it.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's so exhausted, his spirits are so deflated, so worn away, that his hope couldn't even take joy if it succeeded. Even if he succeeds in getting to the Dark Tower, he won't feel any joy. Even if at the very end he does succeed in getting to the Dark Tower, his hope has dwindled into a ghost not fit to cope with that obstreperous joy success would bring. Again, you're not going to find very many poems that use the word obstreperous in them. So his heart springs, but why is his heart happy? What? This is the gladness that some men might be. So his heart springs at what idea?
False hope.
False hope? Yeah. And what is it that his heart finds it can do?
Fail.
Finding failure in its scope. So not success, but failure. So his heart is happy that now finally it may just come to an end and can't succeed, but at least could finally fail. Do you know the line, fail better? Do you know where it's from, Quinn?
No.
It's a famous two-word phrase from Beckett that the point is to fail, but to fail better. It's quoted a lot. I actually don't love it, but it might be that Beckett is thinking of this moment. So his heart leaps up, so to speak. What's that from, Romanticist? My heart leaps up. What?
That's some. Okay, I'm just gonna take a guess. Okay.
Okay.
Coleridge.
His best friend.
What's wrong?
Yeah. Okay. My heart leaps up when I behold a rainbow in the sky. So was it when I was a child? So is it now that I am a man? So shall it be when I grow old, or let me die? And then the next three lines, the last three lines of the poem, are the epigraph to the Intimations Ode. The child is father of the man, and I could wish my days to be bound each to each by natural piety. Browning has a poem about Wordsworth called The Lost Leader, where Wordsworth was this great inspiring leader who just totally lost his ability to inspire because he turned into a crabby old fart, which he did. And so Browning's relation, like Shelley's relation to Wordsworth's Browning, is admired the young Wordsworth, hated the old Wordsworth. So, but yeah, his heart makes a spring. His heart leaps up, finding itself able to fail. At least I can fail. I may not be able to succeed, but at least I can fail. Matthew.
As when a sick man very near to death seems dead indeed and feels begin and end the tears and takes the farewell of each friend and hears one bid the other go, draw breath freely outside, since all is o'er, he saith, and the blow fallen, no breathing can amend.
Okay, so finish the simile.
While some discuss if near the other graves be room enough for this, and when a day suits best for carrying the corpse away, with care about the banners, scarves, and staves, and still the man hears all, and only craves he may not shame such tender blood this day.
Thank you. So that's what finding failure within his scope is. This is the first half of the simile. He's like a sick man near death. And he hears what people are saying around him. This actually turns out to be true, apparently, that hearing is the last sense to go. And so you're cautioned to be very careful when speaking around a deathbed, because you may think the person is dead, but they're not. So a sick man hears people talking and they say it's all over. Just like what is over for Roland. The journey, the quest. And grieving won't do any good. And they start talking about where to put his corpse. And how does he feel that he doesn't even want to stay alive, because at least they are feeling, he's hearing them, their sadness about his death. And he doesn't want to shame such tender love and say, stay. So just like that, thus, Quinn.
Thus, I had so long suffered in this quest, heard failure prophesied so oft, and writ so many times among the band, to wit the knights who through the dark tower search at rest. Their steps that just to fail, as they say, seemed best, and all of doubt was now, should I be dead.
Okay, great. So should I be fit to do what?
Complete the quest.
To complete the quest, but what would that completion be? So a sick man doesn't want to even stay alive because it would shame the tender love of those who are mourning him. It would be a failure for the dying man not to die, which is a really strange idea, that the failure... who was quoting Dickinson a second ago? A minute ago? Okay, yeah. Oh, that's right, both of you. Okay, so yeah. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see, is the last line of Dickinson's poem, always referred to by its first line because it's untitled. I heard a fly buzz when I died. So the last two lines are, and then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see. Or if you think of another Dickinson poem, the one about where she's talking, where Keats is put in the same tomb as she is. She has a lot of poems which are posthumous. The speaker is speaking even though she's dead. Keats asks her, he asked me why I failed. It's the poem is I died for beauty. It's the first line. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when who died for truth was laid in an adjoining room. And then the other person who died for truth says, he asked me why I failed. For beauty, I replied. So that idea of failing, of dying, that the spirit fails, the mind fails, the heart failure, that's what he's describing here, that he wants to fail just because he doesn't want, because in the simile, he doesn't want to shame such tender love and stay. If he can fail for good, fail better, then it'll all be over. So I had so long suffered in this quest, heard failure prophesied so oft. So everywhere he goes, people saying, this is ridiculous, you're going to fail. And then been writ so many times among the band, to wit the knights who to the dark tower search address their steps, that just to fail as they seemed best. So failure has been prophesied. And now, yeah, failing would be best. What does it mean to be writ among the band? Who's the band? Does everyone know what the term to wit means? So been writ so many times among the band, to wit, the knights who do the dark tower search address their steps. So do people know what that phrase means, to wit?
Basically explaining what that means. So he's telling us that the band is the knights who had gone to the dark tower in the past.
Yeah. And so Roland had been writ so many times among the band had been described. People said, oh, you're another member of the band. Mm-hmm. What band? The band of knights who did what?
Looking for the Dark Tower?
Yeah, who addressed their steps to the Dark Tower, who were looking for the Dark Tower. So, and what happened to them? Did they succeed? No, just to fail as they seemed best. But does he want to be described as a member of that band or not? Why not? Okay, so think of the Knights of the Round Table. Okay, let's say they're looking for the Holy Grail. They don't find it. One knight is described as written among the Knights of the Round Table. Is that knight going to complain that he is, or in Spencer, she is... considered one of the knights who is undertaking this noble, near impossible quest?
Probably no.
No. What's puzzling, it's really important to see that what Browning is doing here, which is puzzling, but he really knows what he's doing, is he is taking what should be a mark of esteem. Look. One of the members of the band, the knights whose goal it is to undertake the quest of finding the Dark Tower, and you're one of them. That is so great that, you know, even if you never do it, you're one of this select band of people searching for the Dark Tower who have undertaken this quest. You know, if this were a fairy tale, you would immediately say, yes, he's cool. That's a really cool thing about him, is that he's a member of the band looking for the Dark Tower. If you were a character in that fairy tale world, you would apply to be a member of that band. You would want to be part of the cool kids who are looking for the Dark Tower. But the language here is, no, if you were writ among that band, it turns out you're written among a band of losers. I had heard failure prophesied so oft, synonymous paraphrase, been writ so many times among the band. Who? Those who were searching for the Dark Tower. So hearing failure, being told that you're a failure, and or that you'll be a failure, and being considered part of the band of knights questing for the Dark Tower, those are the same thing. So on the one hand, all the rhetoric of this is pride, which he almost felt before, at being the people involved in this noble quest, being one of them. And yet, now that is synonymous with being a failure. Now, you can make logical sense out of that, which is, oh yeah, someone else chasing after rainbows. Looked like a good idea once, now it looks like a stupid idea. But it's still interesting to see that in this exciting poem, a cripple at a road, sending someone to the Dark Tower, maybe lying, the guy might die, that being a quester is already being described as being a failure. Looking for the Dark Tower or looking to make Shakespeare's line as great as it could be, that is looking for the line about the Dark Tower, is already to acknowledge that you are a failure. So I had so long suffered in this quest, heard failure prophesied so often, been writ so many times among the band, to wit the knights who to the Dark Tower search address their steps, that just to fail as they seemed best, just like the other knights. I can fail the way they do, that seems best. And all the doubt was now, should I be fit? Fit to do what?
Like the other knights?
Yeah. Should I be fit to fail? You know, it's like anyone is fit to fail, right? You want to fail a course, just don't do any work. It's not hard to fail. It might be a Brandeis, but in general, it's not hard to fail. It's hard to succeed. But here the question is, all the doubt was, should I be fit? Would I be able to fail the way they did? Now, one possibility is, but they failed nobly. So you could maybe make that make sense by saying, they failed, but they failed in a very noble manner, and you have to give them credit. But given the, again, synonymity of heard failure prophesied so oft, been writ so many times among the band, it's to fail as they, everyone says you're just going to fail the way they did. They're not saying, ugh. At least they were noble. They're saying, no, you're a schmuck just the way they are. So that is another interesting puzzle about how failure is being described in this poem. Irina.
So far does the spare unturn from him, that hateful cripple out of this his highway into the path appointed. All the day had been a dreary one at best, and dim was settling to its close. Yet shot one grim, red leer to see the plane catch its astray.
Great, thank you. Do you see a little joke there? In the last line of that stanza? Leer. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so spelled differently, but it's as though the day itself is leering at Roland. To see the plane, the tract that he's going down, the plane catch its astray, its target. So it's a dreary day, and he turns the way the hateful cripple points, and the day is about to end, and there's a flash of red as the sun is setting, as though the landscape is leering at him for doing what the hoary cripple told him to do. And he is caught in the trap of this plane. We find out in the next stanza. Leon?
Okay. For Mark, no sooner was I fairly found clutched to the plane after a pace or two, than pausing to throw backward a last view over the safe road. 'Twas gone, gray plain all around. Nothing but playing to the horizon's bound. I might go on, not else remain to do.
So he is caught by the plane. He takes two steps, and suddenly he can't get back to the road. The road is gone. There's only gray plain all around. So what does he do, Julia?
Keep going.
Yeah. So...
So on I went. I think I never saw such starved, ignoble nature. Nothing throve, for flowers as well expect a cedar grove. But cockle, spurge, according to their law, might propagate their kind with none to awe, you'd think. A burr had been a treasure trove.
So a very grim plain vegetation is, to the extent that there was any vegetation, it's all... just desert vegetation, and starved, ignoble nature. So it's all very grim. Even a burr would have been a treasure trove, but Eileen?
No, Henry, inertness and grimness in some strange port or the land's portion. See. Or shut your eyes, said Neptune peevishly.
Nature.
Oh, nature peevishly. It nothing skills, I cannot help my case. As the last judgment's fire must cure this place, Hessian's clods, and set my prisoners free.
Yeah, so nature is saying you might want this to be a more beautiful natural landscape. Can't help you. This plain is just so grim and so barren. And there's nothing I can do about it. The fire of the last judgment has to burn all this up and set my prisoners free. which is to say nature is, all of nature's plants are somehow imprisoned here. Sophia?
If there pushed any ragged thistle stalk above its mates, the head was chopped. The vents were jealous else. What made those holes and vents in the dock's harsh sore thews bruised as the block off hoop of greenness? 'Tis a brute must walk, passing the life out with a brute's intents.
Great. So he's describing the landscape, it's all just undergrowth, but there are holes in the undergrowth somewhere. There must be some brute that was walking around there, walking with a brute's intents. Nothing noble, nothing human about it. Sam?
As for the grass, it grew as scant as hair in leprosy. Thin, dry blades pricked the mud, which underneath looked kneaded up with blood. One stiff blind horse, and his every bone is there. Foods stupefied, however, came there. Thrust out past service from the devil's stud.
So he does see one other mammal, a stiff blind horse. Emaciated, stupefied. Must have been a horse that belonged to the devil, but now was too weak to go on. Samantha.
Alive? He might be dead for aught I know, with that red gaunt and called neck astrain, and shut eyes underneath the rusty mane. Seldom lent such grotesqueness with such woe. I never saw a brute I hated so. He must be wicked to deserve such shame.
Great, thank you. So another amazing line, seldom went such grotesqueness with such woe. That is, this horse is so grotesque, but it's not just an image of grotesquery. It's not, oh, look at that grotesque horse, this shows us where we are. It's that horse is feeling woe. And yet, he still hates the horse. He's so horrified by what he's seeing. I never saw a brute I hated so. And then, he must be wicked to deserve such pain. Probably means something different from what it sounds like it means in 21st century American, which is it's more like we would probably paraphrase that as he has to be wicked because he's in such pain, but a better paraphrase would be for anyone to deserve such pain, they would have to be wicked. So there's no implication that the horse does deserve the pain. There could be. That might be why that might justify his hating the horse. But the line probably means what he's going through, he doesn't deserve. You'd have to be really wicked indeed in a way that horses can't be. So to deserve such pain, he would have to be wicked. And he would really have to be wicked. As we say in Boston, he'd have to be wicked, wicked. It's unlikely. But it causes Roland to do something.
I shut my eyes and turned them on my heart. As a man calls for wine before he fights, I asked one draught of earlier, happier sights. Ere fitly I could hope to play my part. Think first, fight afterwards, the soldier's art. Taste of the old times
and
all
rights. So what does he do?
Mustering up his courage and wisdom.
Yeah, and his earlier idealism. If I can just think of that would get me to play my part fitly. If I could think of these earlier, happier sights. So, one taste of the old time sets all to rights. Quinn?
Not a I fancy cutler's reddened face beneath his garniture of curved gold. Here follow till I almost felt him fold and arm the mind to fix him to the place that way he used. Alas, one night's disgrace. Out went my heart's in fire and left it cold.
Great. So, what's the it there? Sorry?
I don't know.
So it goes back to one taste of the old time. So not this taste. So he thinks back of the old time. And does it set all to rights? Nope. And then he thinks of Cuthbert. Who's Cuthbert? Do we think?
Probably a friend.
There's not a large population of characters in this poem, or even kinds of characters, so that where Cuthbert would be drawn from. So far, there's really been only one plural group mentioned in the poem. Who? The band. So Cuthbert would have been part of the band. One of those who to the Dark Towers, to finding the Dark Tower addressed, to the Dark Tower search addressed his steps. So he thinks of another member of the band that were trying to do this amazing thing, find the Dark Tower. He thinks of Cuthbert's reddening face. And Cuthbert, what do we think of him from that description of the first 4.5 lines? Do we like him or not? I fancied Cuthbert's reddening face beneath its garniture of curly gold. What does that mean?
He's blonde?
Blonde, yeah. Blonde, curly hair. Dear fellow, he's thinking of him, till I almost felt him fold an arm in mind to fix me to the place the way he used. He was almost there for me, and what did he used to do? Well, but he's calling him dear fellow. He's remembering a friendship. That talking to Cuthbert, and Cuthbert would say, whoa, 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 cool, dude. And they would just talk about things. And Cuthbert would be enthusiastic. It's a nice memory that he has. Till I almost felt him fold an arm in mine to fix me to the place the way he used. He used to love that about Cuthbert. That was one of Cuthbert's physical characteristics. Yeah.
I just assumed that Cuthbert and all the other members of the band had died in their pursuit.
Yes.
We're supposed to just assume that.
Well, we'll find out. But it's a good assumption. So he's remembering Cuthbert. It makes him happy. And then he remembers what happened to Cuthbert. Alas, one night's disgrace. So somehow Cuthbert was disgraced. He did something wrong, or he failed in some bad way. He was disgraced. Out went my heart's new fire and left it cold. So he remembers Cuthbert, then he remembers what happened to Cuthbert. Cuthbert, this ebullient, friendly person, somehow got disgraced, and now the fire in his heart went out, left his heart cold. So he thinks of someone else.
Child then, the soul of honor, there he stands, frank as 10 years ago when knighted first. What honest man should dare, he said, he dares. Good, but the scene shifts. Fall. What hangman hands pinned to his breast a parchment? His own bands. Read it. Poor traitor, spit upon him first.
Okay, so here's Giles, the soul of honor, and what happens to him?
He was killed?
Yes.
He was put up to the gallows.
Yeah, he's executed as a traitor. So he always claims to be honest, and then he's executed as a traitor. People become corrupt. People disgrace themselves. People whose ambitions were the best. This is what happens to them. He is a traitor. It's not that Roland is saying they mistakenly accused him of treachery. He says, poor traitor. Spit upon and cursed. His own bands, his own followers read the parchment. So when someone is hanged for treachery, what they've done wrong is pinned to their breast as a kind of confession that their body and that their death makes. So he thinks of these old friends, Cuthbert and Giles, members of the band who to the Dark Tower search address their steps. And It's not that they almost got to the Dark Tower, but then they met a dragon and they lost the battle. It's they address themselves to the Dark Tower, and then it turns out they started a Ponzi scheme. They thought, effective altruism, that's what I'm for. But then they just start a Ponzi scheme and become the opposite of the ideal that they first represented. So,
inspired by this song?
Oh, totally, yeah.
This sounds very Lord of the Rings.
Yes, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so compared to the past, what do we think about the present, Leon?
Better this present than a past like that. Back, therefore, to my darkening path again. No sound, no sight as far as I could strain. Would the night send a howlet or a bat, I asked. When something on the dismal flat came to arrest my thoughts and change their train.
Okay, so he doesn't want to think about his old friends anymore. All of them disgraced. So, but here he is in the middle of nowhere. Doesn't know what's going to happen. It's nighttime. But then something happens. What is it, Julia?
A sudden little river crossed my path, as unexpected as a serpent comes. No sluggish tide, congenial to the gloom. This, as it frothed by, might have been a bath for the fiend's glowing hoof, to see the wrath of its black eddy bespate with flakes and spumes.
Spumes. So this tells us, suddenly there's a river there, and what that tells us, what Browning is doing here with great skill, is saying this whole time he's moving. So it's not like he's just standing in the plain and thinking of Cuthbert and Giles. It's that he keeps going, and then he comes upon this frothy river, black water eddying, that maybe Satan could have, the fiend there is Satan, could have cooled his glowing hooves in. So maybe that's something, except, Eileen?
So petty, yet so spiteful. All along, low scrubby alders kneeled down over it. Drenched willows flung them headlong in a fit of mute despair, a suicidal throng. The river, which had done them all wrong, whatever that was, rolled by, deterred no whit.
Yeah, so remember Thamyris crossing the river as he goes to have his contest with the Muses? There's a lot, if you reread Thamyris Marching after this, you'll hear a lot of echoes. We might even say that Thamyris Marching is a rewriting of this poem. It's another version of the poem, not even a rewriting. I mean, it is a rewriting, but it's not a rewriting with a different outcome. It's a rewriting with the same outcome. It's really interesting to compare the two. That's why Thamyris is foremost of the band, is one of the things that he's called in Thamyris Marching, one of the phrases that I underlined for you last time. Okay, so the little spiteful river just goes on, deterred no whit. And what does he do then?
Which, while I courted, good saints, how I feared, to set my foot upon a dead man's cheek. Each step, I feel the spear I thrust to seek, or hollows, tangled in his hair or beard. It may have been a water rat I speared, but ugh, it sounded like a baby's shriek.
Yeah, so he crosses it, and it's pretty horrifying. And he's afraid they're going to be dead men, and he spears something, maybe just a water rat, but it sounds like a baby shrieking. So how does he feel on the other side, Sam?
Glad was I when I reached the other bank. Now for a better country, famed for sage. Who were the strugglers? What war did they wage? Who savage trampled us with bad and dank, soiled and flash? Toads in poison tank, or wild cats in red-hot iron cage.
Just get to the question mark in the next stanza.
The fight must so have seemed in that fell circle. What penned them there, with all the plain to choose?
Okay, so he crosses. He thinks he'll cross the river, and things will get better. Is he right?
No.
No, vain presage means vain prophecy. I was just wrong. Vain presage. So he sees that this has been the arena of some kind of struggle. Who were the strugglers? What war did they wage? How does he know? Because everything is trampled down. The dank soil is trampled to a plash. It's just smeared all over. It's the dankest of memes. It could be like toads in a poison tank, wildcats in a red hot iron cage. That's what the fight must have looked like in that fell cirque, in that circular area on the plain. Why were they there? They could have gone anywhere. What pinned them there with all the plain to choose? Samantha.
No footprint leading to that horrid news. None out of it. My brewers set to work, their brains threw out like galley slaves of the Turk. It's for his pastime, Christians and its Jews.
So they must have been given some crazy-making drink, the way galley slaves are forced to fight each other, Christians versus Jews, on Turkish galleys in this myth. So he keeps going and sees something else. What's that?
And more than that, furlong on. Why there? What bad use was that engine for? That wheel, or brake, not wheel. That harrow fit to reel, men's bodies held like silk. With all the air of Tophet's tool on earth left unaware, or brought to sharpen its rusty teeth of steel.
So there's some horrible piece of machinery that looks like it's designed to shred human beings. And just as though it's been left there. So this is the grimmest of landscapes, a little bit of industrial waste there, but essentially nothing. So he keeps going, and what comes next?
Then came a bit of stubbed ground, once a wood, next a marsh it would seem, and now mere earth, desperate and dumbly. So a fool finds mirth, makes a thing, and then mars it, till his mood changes and off he goes, within a rude bog, clay, rubble, sand, and stark laughter.
Okay, so the ground, once a wood, then it all deteriorates into bog, clay, and rubble, sand, and stark black dearth. What comes next?
Now blotches rankling, colored gay and grim. Now patches where some leanness of the soil broke into moss or substances like oil. Then came some palsied oak, a cleft in him like a distorted mouth that splits its rim, gaping at death, and dies while it recoils.
Okay, so more horrible vegetation, we could just say. There's a palsied oak, so there is a tree. It's cleft like a distorted mouth, gaping at death and dying. And so is he getting anywhere, Leon?
And just as far as ever from the end, not in the distance, but the evening, not to point my footstep further. At the thought, a great black bird, Apollyon?
Yeah.
Apollyon's bosom friend, sailed past, nor beat his wide-winged dragon pen that brushed my cap, perchance the guide I sought.
So Apollyon is essentially another name for Satan.
Oh.
So out of mythology. So nowhere to go. At the thought, a great black bird came and brushed his cap. So he has no other guide, so he just chases. He just goes after, he doesn't chase. He looks in the direction that the bird has pointed out to him. And then what does he see?
For looking up, aware I somehow grew, spite of the dusk, the plain had given place all round to mountains. With such name to grace, mere ugly heights and peaks now stolen in view. How thus they had surprised me. Solve it, you. How to get from them was no clearer case.
So he looks up as the bird brushes his cap, and he finds that he's surrounded by mountains. Are they sublime? Why not? I mean, how do you know?
Mere ugly heights and heaps.
Yeah, they were, okay, if I call them mountains, but really that name is too flattering to them.
Mm-hmm.
They were just ugly heights and heaths. And he doesn't know how he got surrounded by them. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know how to get out. So he's surrounded by these hills. There's nothing he can do about it. And yet, Eileen.
Yet half I seem to recognize some trick of mischief happened to me. God knows when, in a bad dream perhaps. Here ended then progress this way. When, in the very nick of giving up, one time more came a click as when a trap shuts, you're inside the den.
Okay, so notice then, so he's having an experience of what?
It's like a nightmare.
Yeah. And like a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young album title. You all know that Crosby just died, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Deja vu? Okay. I thought you all liked old rock and roll. Okay, so deja vu, you've seen it before, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like he's seen this before. Half I seem to recognize some trick of mischief happened to me. God knows when, in a bad dream perhaps. So he can't go on any farther. And so he's about to give up one more time, which he's been doing since the start of the poem. It's a poem about giving up. And then he hears a click as when a trap shuts. You're inside the den. So sounds like, yeah, it's all over now. He can't do it. And yet it turns out the shutting of the trap is the change in direction in the poem. If he's been trapped, it means that the trap has been set for him. There's something that he now has to struggle against. So it feels like there's a trap from the start, the hoary cripple advising him to turn aside into the ominous tract, which all agree hides the dark tower. Now he's in the trap. You're inside the den. And that turns out actually to be something new happening. It's not just the same devastation that the poem up to this point in these first 29 stanzas has been describing. But something new is happening because, Sophia.
Sprinkingly it came on me all at once. This was the place, those two hills on the right, crouched like two bulls locked horn and horn in fight, while to the left, a tall scalped mountain, dunce stuttered, a dozing at the very nuts, after a life spent training for the sight.
So, what does he see?
The tower.
Well, he doesn't see it yet. He sees it in the next stanza. But he sees those two hills on the right crouch like two bulls locked horn and horn in fight. This is the place. Where did he get the idea that that would indicate it's the place?
Training for the site.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. That some... in some manuscript, in some legend, in some prophet, telling the members of the band how to find the Dark Tower says, you want to look for a place surrounded by hills, and two of them will be like two bulls, locked horn and horn and fight, and to their left there will be a tall scalp mountain. If you find that, you're in the right place. So... this is the sign that he's in the right place. And he didn't even notice it until this very last moment. He spent a lifetime training for the sight. And then he came upon it without even noticing it. But he hears this click. And so he looks up and he says, ah, here it is. I can't believe I didn't notice it. Okay, Sam.
Built of brown stone with a counterpart in the whole world. The tempest mocking elf, points to the strip and thus the unseen shell he strikes on, only when the timbers start.
So, yeah, there's the tower. He does see it. Sublime, right? No. What in the midst lay but the tower, capital T, itself, the round, squat turret, blind as the fool's heart, built of brown stone, without a counterpart in the whole world. I have to think that whenever he uses the word brown, he can't help remembering his own name, built of brown stone. But notice that essentially what he's saying is, almost literally, the tower turns out to be a pile of shit. The round, squat turret built of brown stone. All his life he was looking for that, and there it is, this tower. The opposite of sublime. So here's this sublime line in Shakespeare, and then here's the tower, which is the opposite of sublime. And it's like he's being shipwrecked here. He saw the tower, it's too late. It's blind as the fool's heart, blind as his own heart. It's over. But how could he not have seen it? Samantha.
Not see, because of the night perhaps, or day, came back again for that before it left. The dying sunset kindled through a cleft. The hills like giants at a hunting way, chin upon hand to see the game at bay. Now stab and end the creature.
Yeah, so if you're asking how could he see the tower when it's already night, he's saying, well, no, day came back. It went through a cleft, and the hills were like giants watching me, the prey of the hunting, about to be captured and killed. And the hills are saying, now stab and end the creature to the heft. The end of Roland 2. Matthew.
Not here. My noise was everywhere. It tolled, increasing like a bell. Names in my ears of all the lost adventurers, my peers. How such a one was strong, such was bold, and such was fortunate, yet each of old, lost, lost. One moment nailed the woe of years.
Thank you. So notice a really cool thing that Browning does here, which is the question not see is a question that a reader might ask. Like, wait a second. I thought you couldn't see. It was all nighttime. How could you see the tower? And he says, I can explain how I could see it. Day came back again for that. And I saw the sunset kindling the hills. And then we get the parallel question, not here, but we wouldn't have asked him that. The question of hearing hasn't come up, but it does for him. So not see, I could see it. Not hear, no, there's noise everywhere, like a bell booming. All tolling the names of all the lost adventurers, my peers. Giles and Cuthbert, how such was bold and such was fortunate, yet each of old lost one moment, knelled the woe of years. Okay, 34, Quinn.
There they stood, ranged along the hillside, met to view the last of me, a living frame, from one more picture. In a sheet of flame, I saw them and I knew them all. And yet, dauntless, the slughorn to my lips, I set and blew, child rolling to the tower, to the dark tower.
So there they all were, all the lost adventurers, his peers. And they're all dead, and yet they've become a living frame for one more picture. In a sheet of flame, I saw them and I knew them all. And then, and yet, that's what he does to the cripple, and yet I did turn as he pointed. And yet, dauntless, the slughorn to my lips I set and blew. Child Roland to the dark tower came. And so what he does here, I'll just say this very briefly, but I think it's really amazing, is, and what he's been doing throughout the poem, is he has been undoing the difference between success and failure. Just to fail as they seemed best, and all the doubt now was, could I be fit? Was I even fit to fail? Here, this is obviously the moment of his death, like that of all the lost adventurers who are now haunting the place, a living frame for one more picture, namely him. And at that moment, he still blows defiance. He still says that line, which has no meaning beyond itself except that Child Roland has come to the Dark Tower. So Browning and Roland turn that line into a climax, and the climax is not one which can be explained any further, but it's simply a dead end, which is where you want to end. You want to end with the dauntlessness of saying Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. Okay, have a good break. I should warn you that there's some pretty dense stuff coming up, especially the cloth, Arthur Hugh Clough, so you might want to get a little jump on it over the vacation. We're going to be reading a kind of, or part of a novel in verse, and it is pretty dense. So that's, if you just look forward, that's around, starts at, sorry, page 229. It's called Ombre du Voyage. And it's great, but it's dense. Okay, have a good break. Bye-bye.